Same technologies that we read about years ago.
I think we moved forward from a bale of straw and a bulldozer, but I'm not sure how much further sometimes when you look at a spill like this. But it does. This kind of a spill is kind of the worst possible problem. It's a choppy, open sea kind of environment with a shoreline not far away, which presents both of the big problems. Hard to catch and damage when it gets away from you, rather than being able to roll out into the ocean and perhaps let nature take its cleanup course. In a conference in San Antonio specifically dealing with oil spills and oil spill technology, it was noted by some of the experts there that the technology had not been moving very far advanced. And it's not only the Environmental Protection Agency and NOAA and Commerce and Coast Guard's responsibility, but it also is a major responsibility of industry to deal with the development of these technologies as well. I think that part of the output and the lessons learned will be to identify the technological gaps, managerial gaps, organizational gaps that exist, and to try to assign them, and to hope that industry will stand forward, and if they don't, for the federal government and other governments to kind of push into those areas of importance.
Well,
but I would hope that industry, excuse me, sir.
I follow up on your point, and it's a good one, that industry has, they're going to have a responsibility for the enormous cost of cleanup. Certainly would have an interest in any new technologies that would not only cut that cost down, but do a better job and prevent some of the damages that might later have to be mitigated. It seems to me that maybe I can get you to make a recommendation to us. While we're putting together a better oil spill liability fund, should we not dedicate some portion of it to extensive R&D in this area?
It would seem to me that there would be a great advantage to dedicating some funds, but not if it's tended to cause industry to stand back and let the government carry the whole ball. It seems to be terribly important that one recognize that a few million dollars spent over each of the last few years would have been a pittance in comparison to the enormous cost of this event. But we who have been in the natural disaster business, which is I was in before I joined EPA, have always noted that there's plenty of money to clean up and never enough money to get ready.
Would you like to jump in here,
maybe
Mr.
Just a little bit. There's a heck of a lot we don't know. On the other hand, there are things that we do know. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't point out that there's been a fair amount of federal resources that have been dedicated to understanding basic things like how oil interacts with marine water, marine life. Indeed, in the Gulf of Alaska, there's a recently published volume, a copy of which we can submit to the committee, which makes an analysis of this very sort of thing. The OXIEP program, which I believe is funded by the Department of Interior, Outer Continental Shelf Environmental Assessment Program, if I recall the acronym, has dedicated over the years close to $100 to $120 million to this sort of understanding. Not necessarily to develop a way in which a magnet can be produced to lift oil out of the water, but to understand the interactions between oil and marine resources. And NOAA also has laboratories, Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory on the West Coast in Seattle, which has devoted some resources. We can provide a more complete...
Well, let me get specific here. Our chronology is our staff has developed it from Coast Guard reports and media reports. Indicates that at 6 p.m. on Friday, a dispersant test was conducted. Our report indicates poor results. Our report indicates that again at 8 p.m. on Saturday, another dispersant test was conducted from C-130 aircraft. Again, not successful. Again, our report indicates that at 4 p.m. on Sunday, another dispersant test by C-130 aircraft was conducted, considered a success. What's strange to me and what I found strange in the testimony of the chairman of Exxon is that here we are faced with this enormous spill and we're out there testing the capacity of dispersants to work in that environment. The extraordinary thing, and I hope you're impressed with the same feeling I got, was that the time to be doing testing? Should not the testing of dispersants in that environment have been conducted earlier? And shouldn't we know what to expect? And by the time a spill occurs, ought we not be prepared to make a decision? Use it or don't use it? What's wrong with what happened here? I mean, am I off base here? Or am I correct that we were literally doing our testing at the very wrong time? And we should have been applying the lessons we should have learned in tests conducted sometime earlier.
I'll respond just briefly to that, Mr. Chairman. It's always easy to be the Monday morning quarterback.
I understand.
Notwithstanding that, I can say that NOAA has been a part of significant research in this area. Indeed, there was a National Academy of Science study that was conducted over a period of a couple of years with regard to the effectiveness of dispersants used on oil spills. As I say, we participated in that. And as has been alluded to earlier in this hearing, the results of that study were that they are very effective. They can be effective. Yes, they can be less effective under certain circumstances, and I'm not going to sit here and second guess the decisions made by the Coast Guard and the local authorities. Indeed, we've learned a lot. I think we can better construct contingency plans to maybe tighten the latitude in which decisions are made in these sorts of circumstances.
But let me be specific. You're not prepared with the knowledge you have about this one little area, dispersions, to recommend it for use in a spill like this, or recommend it not be used? Yes or no, go, don't go decision?
I think we can make that sort of recommendation. There's one other issue that hasn't been alluded to here.
Well, let's not leave. Let's not go further first. If you are prepared to make that recommendation, what was it? Was it a go decision or a don't go decision?
We've been a part of the study in which it was described that, yes, it makes sense to use them.
All right. Assuming then that the study did occur prior to the spill, that the recommendation was to use it, why didn't we just use it rather than conduct 3 days of tests before the weather got so bad we couldn't do anything?
Again, it's difficult for me, Mr. Chairman, to understand all the dynamics associated with that particular situation and the set of factors involved. The contingency plans, the law allows for latitude to be exercised on the part of the on-site coordinator to consider all that. One of which, Mr. Chairman, again, that has not been alluded to, is frankly concerns on the part of the populace and the local area, frankly the fishermen, as to the use of those dispersants. That needs to be understood as a factor. I don't know how heavily it was weighed. I was not there. I don't know all the considerations that were made.
I mean, that's what's so terribly confusing, Tristan. We need to get that straight. I mean, my understanding was the state participated in the contingency plan, that dispersants were a part of those contingency plans. You tell us now that you had done studies on it prior to this time and are willing now to say that you would have recommended it be used, and yet instead of using it, we spent 3 days testing until it got too late to be useful anymore. It seems to me it points to a glaring deficiency in the manner in which response is carried out. Now, you fellas are part of a national response team. And one of the things I hope you will do for us following this hearing is to not only make a report to the president, but to be specific to us about what went wrong here. And I suspect I've just put my finger on one of them. If contingency plans provide too much latitude, that we've got to worry about bureaucracies deciding whether to use them or not in the middle of an emergency, after you've already recommended they should be used, then we have a terrible problem with the way we've structured those plans. Am I wrong?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I think that the plan specifically identified the use of dispersants in two of the three zones under very specific approval prerogatives, primarily because you had to relate it to the particular environment that was going on at the time. Dispersants are kind of fickle animals. Sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. Depends on the temperature of the water and the height of the seas.
It's like detergents in your laundry, right? I
mean, yes, sir. But
depending upon what kind of laundry, cold water, hot water, and everything else.
But they also sometimes leave behind some toxic or emotional effects, and there's great care taken to the approval of particular kind of dispersants. Frankly, for some of those zones, there were pre-approved dispersants which could be used. But it was not in the open sea immediately around. That was not already in place in the open sea around where this accident occurred. I think the second part of it was that the test does have to prove that it would be effective under those sea conditions. And as you said, twice it did, and twice it did not work very well, and the third time it worked a little bit. And then the wind came up, and it wouldn't have worked very well in the choppy sea. So all those considerations, it seems to me, get cranked in. And sitting in Washington, D.C., I can only say that it was an experienced unseen coordinator with the advice of NOAA and others who watched that test and decided in conjunction with locals and decision makers that it shouldn't proceed. I think lessons learned must include the issue of dispersion.
Mr. Chairman, do we have too many generals? in this field?
I believe that there's only one general in this scene, sir. It was the on-scene coordinator who would make the final decision to use or not use, seeking consultation from the trustee agencies and the state.
How is your response team coordinated? Do you speak with one voice when it comes to making recommendations?
The regional response team in the field is advisory to the on-scene coordinator.
Only advisory?
Yes, sir.
On-scene coordinator then decides.
And if it was an EPA on-scene coordinator, as it was, as it frequently is in other inland spills, the EPA person would make the decisions with the advice of Coast Guard and others. In this instance, it was a Coast Guard person with the advice of NOAA's special scientific coordinator and EPA and other agencies.
I have rarely bumped into situations where there has been interagency overlap of jurisdiction, where there hasn't been some turf battle. Are the turf battles settled here? Is everybody working together?
It seems to me that for the most part the roles are pretty clear. They're specified by regulation. Most of the people at the national level have been working together for a long time, and I think that the old statement about if we don't hang together, we'll sure all hang separate is very valid in this case. I think the fact that the national response team mechanism has existed for more than 20 years, originally being created not for an American incident at all, but to be sure that if we had an American incident, we'd have a competence and roles would be clear and understood. I have with me Mr. Ken Bigley, who was the first chairman of the national response team some 20 years ago, from your state, sir.
And must be a good fellow.
And it's our judgment that you will never eliminate all turf. That's not possible, but I think when you do have an event like this, people pull together. I think we will have some turf as we develop this report, but I think we will reconcile those issues as well, sir.
Mr. Olson, you've been...
Yeah, speaking from the Park Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, and the state of Alaska, I think there's been excellent cooperation at the field level.
Now, you also all alluded to the work that is being done to save what can be saved of... oil damage, animals, and birds. In that regard, I've seen on television quite a bit of volunteer efforts. Organizations are apparently on the scene as well as our government agencies. Are those private organizations coordinated under your umbrella, or are they operating separately?
We have some volunteers that are up from the state of California. We have some volunteers from Alaska. One of the problems is we have many more volunteers want to volunteer than we can accommodate. And when you think of trying and operate a cleanup organization 25 or 30 miles from Valdez and four boats and operating in cold water, rocky cliffs, oily situations, you can run people all over each other if you're not careful. So I think we're utilizing volunteers as much as we can, and they're pretty effective.
One final thing. When can we expect, I realize there are long-term consequences no one can measure now, but at least in the short term, when can we expect some definitive report that details the extent of the damage to the fish and wildlife of the area?
From our standpoint, we have a daily report that comes in, and it seems like, and we will continue that probably for the next several weeks or months. And that entails every sea otter that was picked up and every bird that was picked up, and those were cleaned. Sea otters that might have been shipped elsewhere, anticipated problems in the island of Kodiak. So we, on a daily basis, keep on top of it.
We're doing the same thing working with the Department of Interior. We get the same daily reports, which are coordinated in the field, and as we can, we try and make economic assessments of the value. Let me just mention a word, though, with regard to the more major work product that we're coordinating with trustee agencies, and that's the coordination of a damage assessment plan, which is a major effort, which will take much longer time and cost, frankly, several millions of dollars to develop. That will be the basis upon which long-term claims are made against responsible parties, and we can have a better grasp on the consequences of the action. In the meantime, though, we will do the best we can, indeed on a daily basis, to assess and report the immediate damages as we observe them.
And finally, in regard to the expenses you're incurring both with the plan you talked about as well as with the expenses on a daily basis. Are those expenses recoverable from the All Spill Liability Fund, or is that part of your regular budget?
Speaking for NOAA, and I would assume for the other trustee agencies, the mechanisms will be similar. In one respect, I know they will be. With regard to our immediate expenses, we have established an account within our budget, which is charged against the 311K budget, which we will bill the Coast Guard for, which they in turn seek reimbursements for. With regard to the costs that we incur for the more major damage assessment plan, we have been in consultations with the other trustee agencies, including the state of Alaska, as well as Exxon, and are on the verge of establishing a contractual understanding with those parties, which will establish an assessment fund, which we will draw from in the next several months and years to fund the assessment work that may take anywhere from 3 to 6 years.
Well, again, as we put together all spill liability legislation, it would be very important for us to have some clear understanding of the problems you've experienced in this area and how those might properly be addressed in that legislation. Just you and I, fellas. Thank you very much for your testimony, and we very much appreciate today and hearing from you in the future. We would like to be in the loop, if you will, of those reports that you are issuing as they are issued. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
The final panel will consist of Mr. Quinn O'Connell, the Trans-Alaskan Pipeline Liability Fund, and Mr. Pete Islieb, Prince William Sound Aquaculture Association of Cordova, Alaska. And if you gentlemen will please again summarize your testimony with the knowledge that your full written testimony will be made a permanent part of our record. We'll begin with Mr. Quinn O'Connell of the Trans-Alaskan Pipeline Liability Fund. Mr. O'Connell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appear here as counsel for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Liability Fund. This fund is a non-profit private corporation established by Congress in 1973 as part of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Authorization Act. Among other things, it is provided in that act that the owner and operator of a vessel that spills taps oil, that is, oil that has been transported by the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, shall be strictly liable without regard to fault for the first $14 million worth of damage that results from that spill. The fund itself is made strictly liable for any damages in excess of the first $14 million up to a $100 million maximum for any one incident. Strict liability ceases when the oil is first brought ashore at a port under the jurisdiction of the United States. In any case where strict liability is imposed and the damage is caused by another person's negligence, the owner and operator of the vessel and the fund, as the case may be, shall be subrogated under applicable state and federal laws to the rights of those claimants who have received compensation. The fund was funded by collecting 5 cents per barrel from the owner of the oil at the time it was loaded on a vessel. The collection ceased when $100 million was accumulated and would be resumed if the accumulation in the fund falls below $100 million.
The fund was funded by,
as I mentioned, the fund is a non-profit corporation administered pursuant to regulations prescribed by the Secretary of the Interior. Under these regulations, the Board of Trustees of the fund consists of one person designated by each of the pipeline right-of-way holders, and three persons designated by the Secretary of the Interior at least one of which is recommended by the governor of Alaska.
Under these regulations, the Board of Trustees.
Under these secretarial regulations, other items that are addressed are the nature of the investments the fund is allowed to make, the general procedures for making claims against the fund, definition of terms, and other pertinent data.
Under these secretarial
as required by the Secretary's regulations, the fund has also promulgated its procedures for settling claims.
The general
copies of these, the pertinent statutory provisions, the Secretary's regulations, and the fund's procedures have been submitted to the subcommittee. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much, Mr. O'Connell. Isleeb?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Pete Isleeb, and I'm a fisherman from Prince William Sound. I have been a fisherman there for over 25 years. I've done more than fish. I've served on many civic and resource agencies.
I'm a fisherman.
Normally at this time of year I'd be out fishing. I would be fishing right within sight of where the Exxon Valdez is, where it was up until yesterday.
What would you be fishing?
I would be fishing herring in a Rowan kelp pound fishery for herring eggs.
Normally at this time of year I'd be out fishing. I would be fishing right within sight.
It feels like I've come full circle. Almost 20 years ago, I wrote Senator Bartlett a letter about the marine leg of the pipeline, complaining, wondering why there wasn't an alternate to that pipeline other than going to the marine system. We were on the continent. The oil was going to the Midwest. The fishermen,
I guess I was
among the fishermen that got concerned, and we went to court.
To that pipeline, other than going to the
we took that, and we were winning in court, and it was taken away by the Senate.
The oil was going to the Midwest.
That's a long story. We ended up getting the pipeline.
The fishermen.
Principal investigator in assessing the marine mammal and marine bird populations in Prince William Sound under contract to Fish and Wildlife.
That's a long story. We ended up getting the pipeline.
It seems interesting to hear the Fish and Wildlife representatives talk about the numbers of critters that may be impacted by the spill, Mr. Chairman, but when the National Audubon Society called me up here 10 days ago, I gave them almost identical numbers he mentioned, and I even gave him more, which I think will future numbers, which will probably be more pertinent in the future.
The Audubon Society called me up here 10 days ago. I gave.
I've served on the City Council in Cordova, and I've served on the Board of Fisheries, a regulatory body for all of Alaska's fisheries. Been involved in, and presently in town,
which will probably be more
unfortunately. Because I'm not fishing, but for the International North Pacific Fisheries Commission, I'm advisor in that body with the Japanese and the Canadians. I'm also involved in the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council as an advisor. So much for my personal record. I have a comment that was turned in to me by the city manager of Cordova last night, and I'd like to read it to you. The city manager, it's a statement of the city manager of Cordova, Donald L. Moore, April 5th, 1989.
I have a comment.
The people of Cordova, Alaska are privileged to live and work in one of the two most beautiful places on earth, the formerly pristine Prince William Sound. As the world knows, on March 24th, 1989, the fully loaded tanker Exxon Valdez hit a well-marked reef near Bligh Island and spewed 10.5 million gallons of crude oil into the Sound. We are now experiencing a catastrophe of unprecedented impact on our environment, our economy, and our way of life. Most unfortunately, the impact is worse than it needs to be because we trusted those who professed to know how to triage their own negligence.
We are now experiencing a catastrophe.
In the early phase of the spill, we in Cordova expected Exxon to mobilize and clean up the spill and begin assisting Cordova and other sound communities with recovery efforts.
We trusted those.
The truth is that the people of Cordova
their own negligence.
Reached into their own treasury and began cleaning up the spill and protecting uncontaminated areas of the sound while Exxon helped its out-of-town experts react.
The truth is that the people...
It is not a joke that the inevitable souvenir T-shirts were deployed before the containment boom was around the Exxon Valdez. In our view, the Exxon has mustered only a fraction of its available resources to clean up the spill. The city of Cordova and its two villages in the Sound are totally dependent upon commercial and subsistence fishing for our existence. Cordova's annual operating budget depends upon direct program revenues from commercial fishing for one-third to one-half of its operating revenue. Indirectly, the entire city economy is supported by fishing. In 1988, Cordova, a town of 3,000 persons, was the eighth largest fishing port by value in the United States. We have no pipeline terminal or tourist ship industry to offset loss to our basic industry. On April 3rd, 1989, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game announced that our herring fishery days were over. The impact of the spill on the salmon fishery is yet to be known.
We have no pipeline terminal.
The Exxon Valdez disaster threatens a number of public-private economic development projects for Cordova, such as our Dock Gurry line, fish processor construction, harbor improvements, and other public work projects, such as bonding for our elementary school construction. We also greatly fear the socioeconomic displacements that will afflict our community as a result of this tragedy.
Harbor improvements and other public work projects, such as bonding for our elementary school construction. We also greatly fear the socioeconomic displacements that will affect our.
You're not. It's not all what they're saying of this
tragedy.
Is what meaning what they've done. They have addressed, but you seem to have to call them.
It's not
I
all
guess.
What they're saying is what.
There are
what they've done.
Various cries for help. I'd like to reflect a couple that I've got, and I will put in a record for you at later time. I am down on the record as representing the Prince William Sound Aquaculture Corporation, where I was one of the founding fathers and still on the board of directors. But the organization operates three world-class hatcheries, three of the five biggest in the world in Prince William Sound. The value of their return this year is over $50 million, or hopefully will be, under last year's prices.
Operates three world-class hatcheries, three of the five biggest.
They, in their fight to save some of the hatcheries, have had almost insurmountable hurdles to get the equipment.
Under last year's prices.
I could relate some interesting stories of where airplanes were usurped and
some of the hatcheries have had almost
freight was unloaded and put on a plane that Exxon chartered just so that they could say they handled it.
I could relate
there
some
is
interesting stories.
Tremendous frustration by the administrators of the organization. And they reached into their own budgets for millions of dollars, as did the city of Cordova to assist its own budget for millions of dollars. It's not saying that they won't be reimbursed at some point in time. It's just that they had to do it then, and it was only last night Exxon called, 12 days later.
And they reached into their own budgets for millions of dollars, as did the city of Cordova to assist its own budget.
I'd like to relate something that also happened several years ago. It seems like almost 12 years to today, we were having a symposium in Cordova. It was hosted by Sea Grant and by the Cordova District Fisheries United. That was well attended. There was probably 150 people there. I was one of the hosts of panel members. We're having a symposium. Then Admiral Jack Hayes, who later became commandant, was a panel member with me, and we were arguing and discussing and talking about the route. And it was promises from him, and as well as other ARCO and Exxon and Alyeska people, that let us use the let the lieutenant governor today use the word betrayed. I think the betrayal is not from the drunken sailor. The betrayal is from the adequacy of the industry and government to live up to their promise to be able to handle the magnitude of that sort of spill.
I think the betrayal is not from the drunken sailor. The betrayal is from the adequacy.
At this symposia, there was a story, a hypothetical story, presented by then Representative Keith Specking of the state legislature. He built a scenario of a tanker coming out of Valdez Arm and smacking right into Fly Island Reef. I have the story on a desk back in Cordova. It's interesting to read through it, and only happily the ship burst into flame and the sound was for the most part saved. And that scenario was one that he read to the audience at that symposium. There are many tanker stories that have not been mentioned here or other places. Tankers that on outbound out of Prince William Sound, one here a few years ago, and they lost power, complete power. And this captain was a hero. He turned the thing hard over to the left and made a U-turn and came back into the sound. He would have normally driven straight out of the sound and come back in and hit Montague Island, and the whole outer part of the sound would have been awash in oil. There would be no way to save the vessel because it didn't regain power until 16 hours later.
Made a U-turn and came back.
Even with tugs and other vessels nearby, there was just the seas were 50 to 60 knots and unable to get a line on a tug like that. And it was only half an hour from the rocks on night on Naked Island, near where this tanker is now being salvaged, is where that occurred.
Even with tugs and other vessels nearby,
I'm not sure the exact year, it might have been about 1980. There are several others of stories of tankers losing power. There are a couple of tanker tales of them finding themselves out of British Columbia or Washington State and listing. They've lost large quantities of oil from a cracked seam.
Losing power.
And nobody ever did see that oil again. It just happened to dissipate 200 miles offshore somewhere. But I'm sure there were a few cries in the wilderness. They may not have been human, but they were cries in the wilderness. The fishermen have been concerned about the Alyeska terminal and its chronic pollution of Port Valdez. They have been, the Cordova fishermen have been after EPA and our own state Department of Environmental Conservation to work to clean up the act. Alyeska has not spent most of the money it was supposed to spend to properly treat its ballast water. And the aromatic hydrocarbons leaving that plant are beyond air quality regulations.
Most of the money it was supposed to spend to properly...
This spill is now headed west, or a good hunk of it.
It's ballast water.
And it's going toward Kodiak. Kodiak is the first port in the nation and ex-vessel.
Air quality regulations.
Dollars. It swings by Kodiak, if it goes in a gyre, as expected, will it end up into the eastern Bering Sea, the Aleutians, and Bristol Bay?
And it's going toward Kodiak. Kodiak is the first.
Now, let me put this into perspective, what this means, Mr. Chairman.
Please.
Dollars.
And this time of year is the most critical time of year. I'm not a marine biologist. I'm an ornithologist, but not a marine biologist. But from what I understand from my associates, that it's not just the fry salmon that are leaving the streams and the hatcheries. It's not just the herring eggs that will be hatching and the little larval floating away down the bay. It's many other, some of the bottom fish. It's the crab, larval that'll, their eggs are hatching. The larval will float near the surface waters and drift. And at these times, these early life stages are especially susceptible to petroleum hydrocarbons. All the data that was shown us years ago, back in the early 70s, was available and said that it was a critical time. And I don't think we will know the full tale for a decade or more.
All the data that was shown us years ago.
The salmon fry alone leaving Prince William Sound for 1989 season, we have about 675 million little fry, little salmon, smoked salmon, leaving Prince William Sound from hatcheries alone, on hundreds of more million leaving the stream.
The salmon fry alone.
And they'll go the same direction, in the same trajectory as the
we have
oil,
675
and they'll be following them within days because they're coming out of the streams. Matter of fact, the hatcheries are holding them right now to keep them from releasing them in the environment.
And they'll go the same.
And they will be going on the same directory westward through the Gulf.
How long can you hold them, Mr.? You said before they must be released.
Well, it depends on the species and depends on how much capacity they have.
I would say only
a short time, in a matter of weeks, that they can hold them. I would say that they would have to be start releasing them somewhere, whether they transport them somewhere to release, which creates a whole different scenario of a problem. But I would say they have to release them within a couple of weeks. And that oil is going to be there a while. And it's not just release them and they go to sea and they drift out where the oil is. They're going to have to be living on the planktonic life within Prince William Sound for several weeks before they go to sea. They'll have to be living within the upper elements of the water column, feeding on planktonic life. And that planktonic life catches it from the oil and is impacted by that oil.
Let me ask you something. You all, as representatives of the Aquaculture Association, are you all receiving any kind of advice from our federal agencies on exactly how to respond in terms of withholding releases or perhaps whether or not you ought to release any given area?
I'm afraid that, as far as that goes, we are the experts.
You're ahead of them.
Yes.
Advice from
And I don't profess to represent Prince William Sound Aquaculture, but the people we hire are the experts.
Whether or not you ought to release any given area.
And
I'm afraid that
they are
you're ahead of them.
Astute people.
Let me ask you, you've heard the Lieutenant Governor and the Mayor of Valdez earlier today. I believe you were here most of the day.
Yes.
And you heard them say that they didn't hear too many words of comfort. Although I thought I heard some, they didn't hear too much in the way of comfort that the damages that their citizens, particularly those who must depend upon the resources of the sea, were going to be fully compensated, although they were not going to be compensated in time to incur significant damage. Have you got a different impression, or do you agree with the governor and the mayor?
I agree with the mayor wholeheartedly. I'm from a Connecticut originally, not Missouri, but I still got to see it to believe it.
Have you got a different impression, or do you agree with
Prince William Sound Aquaculture Corporation? Operates just where I think the oil hasn't reached it. They have booms in front of it, the largest salmon hatchery in the world. And We did, the print, it's operated by, I mean, it's directed by fishermen. The board of directors made up of fishermen. Fishermen started this organization. It's a private nonprofit organization.
I got you.
And we did it because we were concerned about the ability of the wild systems to maintain themselves during harsh seasons. We had the earthquake in 64, and that even year cycle was very damaged after that, even year pink salmon, which is every 2 years. And that's the reason we put the hatcheries in. And it was really in 74 when we started the hatchery program, it was apparent we were going to need it because we might lose them.
Well, it's certainly true now that you need it more than ever, I suppose.
Yeah.
Mr. Eastlip, let me mention to you that, you know, the area I represent, Louisiana, is losing about 70 square miles a year in coastal erosion. And the story you tell about, particularly the letter you read from Condova, I guess is one I have had repeated a thousand times from people who live along that coast and watching it diminish and watching those resources lost and the livelihoods and heritage destroyed in the process. It's one I'm very sensitive to and one I'm very concerned about. I'd like, though, however, to turn to this TAPS fund to see whether or not we prepared for it properly, whether we're going to respond to it in a good way. There was some concern earlier that the TAPS fund sets some sort of cap on liability. That isn't true, is it? It only sets a cap on no-fault liability to the operator of the vessel. The vessel owner who disperses all Exxon remains liable for the damages, period. And they have assumed that liability. Is that correct, Mr. O'Connell?
That's my understanding, Mr. Chairman. The TAPS Act, which creates the fund, is very limited. It establishes strict liability without regard to fault for all vessel owners and operators who spill TAPS oil. The basis of the $14 million was at the time that it was enacted, that this law was enacted, that was the amount of financial responsibility that was required under the Federal Water Pollution Control Act. But that
limitation has no.
That's just where they.
Just no fault.
That's just no fault. You got to pay it no matter what. That's right.
Beyond that,
they created the fund.
TAPS fund is created to cover additional expense, and you have a full right to go against the party who has caused the damage for recovery to the fund of the balance you pay out. Is that correct?
Yes, you have the right of subrogation for any of those claimants to go against anyone whose negligence under the state or federal laws may have been responsible for the spill.
Now, as I understand the chairman's bill, that fund will, and others will be all accumulated into one master program under that bill, and therefore the rules are going to change, but the rules didn't change. And this fund was called upon to make expenditures to assist in all of the damages that Prince William Sound has experienced and that they will continue to experience in terms of damages to long-term to the livelihood of people in the area. As I understand it, you're authorized to go ahead and assess that $0.05 a barrel again and to recover, to keep that fund at $100 million. Is that correct?
That is correct. If we fall below $100 million, we start collecting 5 cents a barrel.
That's with or without the right of subrogation. What happens if you do start collecting it again, you raise the money back up to $100 million, but you also recover whatever you spent from Exxon by right of subrogation? What happens under that circumstance?
Well, at the moment, we have more than $100 million in the fund, and since in this incident we can't be liable for any more than $86 million, the difference between $14 million and $100 million, if we paid out the entire $86 million, we would still have money in the fund above
the $100 million. So you just simply keep it in the fund and quit collecting at that point?
That's right.
Now, who owns Alyeska?
Alyeska is a corporation owned by the seven holders of the right-of-way for the Trans-Alaska pipeline.
And who are they?
Who owns Alyeska?
Let me think about it. They're the pipeline subsidiaries of Unocal Exxon, Arco, BP America, Mobil,
seven holders of the right-of-way,
Phillips,
for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
And who are they?
You did awfully good.
Amarada Hess.
Amarada Hess. They're the contributors to the TAPS fund, aren't they?
No. Contributors to the TAPS fund are the owners of the oil at the time that the oil was loaded on board a tanker. The Alyeska only runs the pipeline.
You did awfully good.
They don't own any of the oil.
So it could be two separate parties. They're the contributors to the TAPS fund could be separate parties from the Alyeska.
Yes, there are many contributors to the TAPS fund that don't have any interest in the pipeline.
And yet you have some that overlap.
And then the producing companies that are affiliated with the pipeline companies, like Exxon, or ARCO, might have a production company. They may have paid money into the fund. Their pipeline subsidiary didn't, technically.
So as we sort out all the responsible, or perhaps responsible funds here, Alyeska is out there with some responsibility. TAPS fund is out there with some responsibility. The owner of the oil, the tanker, is out there with responsibility, all of whom can respond in some respect to the damages that this oil spill has incurred. Is that correct?
Alyeska's out there with some.
That's certainly the potentially correct. Yes. I don't want to say who's liable for what, but that's true.
Out there with all of whom can. Now that Exxon has indeed assumed responsibility for the cleanup, the obvious question is: what role will the TAPS fund play in the aftermath of the incident?
Correct. Well, I think that remains to be seen. Once $14 million of claims have been certified as being valid, the next $86 million the fund is liable for, unless someone else pays it.
Well, that's the point. I mean, if Exxon has assumed responsibility, and if they live up to what I heard today was an awfully... damages as they could possibly settle, will the TAPS fund be used at all?
If someone else picks up those claims and damages, the TAPS fund only pays if they have a claim against them. And
could possibly settle, will the TAPS fund be used at all?
If someone else picks up those claims and damages, the TAPS fund only pays if they have a claim against them. And the TAPS fund only pays if they have a claim against them, and if they don't have a claim against them, they don't pay.
Who can claim against the TAPS fund?
Anybody that's damaged as a result of an oil spill of TAPS oil.
So that if someone is unhappy with the way they're being...
TAPS fund only pays if they have a claim against them, and if they don't have a claim against them, they don't pay.
Who can claim against the TAPS fund?
Anybody that's damaged as a result of an oil spill of TAPS oil.
They're not getting their claims adjusted properly. They have the additional right of appealing to the TAPS fund for settlement of their claims.
Once the $14 million level has been met, that is correct.
I'm sorry, I did not follow that. Why does not a party have the right to claim within that $14 million cap if, in fact, there's no fault liability there?
Because the fund is not responsible, strictly liable for the first $14 million worth of damage. The owner and operator of the vessel is strictly liable without regard to fault.
So that a citizen, a fisherman, a group who is injured by this incident will have to wait until Exxon pays out $15 million of damage claims before they can appeal to your fund for help?
Well, they don't have to pay them out, but there will have to have been $14 million that we consider to be valid claims, yes. And we are coordinating with Exxon at the moment. We have our own adjusters to assess claims that will come into Exxon. And as long as they are valid claims, while we credit them, I mean, we...
When are they going to know
attribute that to the first $14 million. Once it becomes more than $14 million, then if nobody else picks it up, we satisfy those claims.
I guess the obvious question for people like Mr. Eastlieb and others who are similarly situated, when are they going to know that this $15 million ceiling has been reached and that your fund is now available for them to apply for assistance?
Well, at the moment, if we get a claim, we send it to Exxon.
I understand that.
If it comes to $14 million, or if any claim that Exxon says we won't pay, that Exxon will send them to the fund.
Well, I understand that.
Will
you do anything in terms of a public announcement?
Oh, yes. We will be advertising in the local papers.
And
all of the procedures are available.
You will tell people at some point Exxon has paid or been credited with $15 million worth of damage claims. From now on, if you're unhappy with your settlement procedures with Exxon, you may apply to our TAPS fund for assistance.
We have under the regulations, we are required to advertise in local papers within 45 days of our being aware of the incident, and as soon as we feel that there is justification for thinking it's going to be over $14 million.
Well, I don't think there's any question this thing is going to exceed
that
level. You and I both know it. When are you going to, in fact, notify the public, fishermen and others in the community, that they have the right to make application to your fund?
Well, within several days or a week or two, I would think. We're getting our claims people together. We now have an adjustment. We're not an operating company, and so as soon as this has happened, we've had to get an adjuster on board. We want to try and work out with Exxon to make sure that we both are coordinated.
Mr. Connell, I'm not the congressman from Alaska, but were he here?
Yes.
Were the congressman from Washington State here, Mr. Miller, I'm sure they'd be extraordinarily interested in hearing from you that, in fact, you have made that public announcement and you are now in operation prepared to assist people in the area. And for that reason, as chairman, I would request that you communicate that information to this committee as soon as you have in fact made a decision on that public announcement. You've reached that point, if you don't mind.
We will do so, and it will be shortly.
Mr. Eastlip, you wanted to answer.
Yes, I'm not sure what my claim, if any, will entail, or when I will. I may be interested in making a claim 5 years hence. And so claims are not necessarily something that I can go and tap and say I'm due so much. I don't know. I won't know.
Let me make the point. I think perhaps in the public announcements that Mr. O'Connell and others are going to be hopefully making that clear to people, there are statutes of limitations and there are problems of, as Mr. Rawl pointed out, of remote damages that may not be recoverable. And it's going to be very important for those of you who do have valid claims to assert them timely and adequately in order to receive compensation. So let me assure you that you may not be able to wait 5 years.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure that my partners will notify me if I need to be involved. They're all working on other aspects of this up there. Some other questions or some statements here. I was on and over the tanker within a few hours. And, of course, I saw nobody but a pilot boat and then the flying around. And I saw the Coast Guard helicopter come in. And finally, a few hours later, the governor's plane flew in. And as late as 14 hours after the incident, I saw no response of any sort in any way, shape, or form.
We've got the same picture here.
Yeah, I got the picture in my briefcase. I mean, I can show you one. There will be a video letter to Congress for you to view, sent by the fishermen and by other interested parties there. One of our questions right now is, what are the capabilities and what will be the immediate contingency plans? I mean, they talk about all this boom and stuff, and I don't think they've got it in a position, should this, heaven forbid, reoccur tomorrow, that they can handle it again. And
well, that's going to be our major assignment, believe me, is examining, in fact, what happened to assess whether or not the next time, God forbid, something like this happens, we're not better prepared to deal with it.
As well as I heard immediately wondering why this wasn't burned.
I asked the same question.
They thought that it should have been burned. And, you know, you could, with or without the tanker, it should have been burned.
Yeah. I've answered the very same question earlier today.
There are a couple
other
things.
We're going to have to wrap now, and let me make a suggestion. If you have additional questions you would like our committee to explore, we'd be more than happy to receive those questions, and believe me, we'll explore them for you. We'll insist on some answers.
We're hoping to see you in field hearings in Prince William Sound in a couple of months.
We'll be down.
And one of the things the fishermen, as a last parting word, that they're interested in is possibly a new fund for, let's say, something like 2 bits, a barrel coming out of that tube that goes to the rehabilitation, enhancement, restoration, and research for Prince William Bay crude, wherever it may go, in Prince William Sound or whether it goes westward and so forth.
Well, believe me, we have a bigger problem than even this enormous catastrophe you've experienced. We've got hazardous cargo traveling the harbors and the ports and the rivers of this nation from one end to the other. And unfortunately, you've been visited by this catastrophe, but it is a catastrophe that could visit almost any port, any harbor and bay of the continental U.S. and Hawaii. As a result, believe me, we'll be looking at major revisions in the manner in which we prepare for and finance not only response, but long-term restoration. Thank you very much for being with us today. I want to thank all of you who've been very patient all day with us, and we will now adjourn this hearing, but we will again make the announcement that before this month is out, we will be hearing at this committee level hearings on the actual oil spill liability bill, and prior to that time, we will appreciate any submissions that you would like to make for us to consider in drafting that legislation. Thank you very much. This hearing is adjourned.